Welcome to Local Exposure, a podcast about music and the greater Cincinnati scene. I'm Jim Nolan. Classic rock icons Dave Mason and Steve Cropper bring their Rock and Soul Review to Bechtold Park in Sycamore Township on July 13th. As part of WVXU's Around Cincinnati, I had the unique pleasure to speak with both musicians. I spoke with Dave Mason about his band and the tour, and I spoke with Steve Cropper about Stax Records, Booker T and the MGs, and his relationship with Otis Redding. This episode of Local Exposure is a rebroadcast of WVXU's Around Cincinnati. It was recorded by me and produced by Lee Hay. The theme music is by Scott Holmes and comes from the Free Music Archive. You can find out more at freemusicarchive.com. You can also find more great local arts and music stories at wvxu.org/aroundcincinnati. And now I invite you to enjoy this special conversation I had with Dave Mason and Steve Cropper. Thanks for listening. Dave Mason, thanks for taking the time to speak with me today.
No problem.
The Rock and Soul Review Tour is kicking off July 5th in Salina, Kansas. What's the catalyst that brought you and Steve Cropper together for this tour?
That was the stuff we were listening to when I was 16, 17 years old, trying to emulate.
Are you saying he's sort of a guitar hero of yours?
Well, you know, I mean, Cropper's got a very unique style. It's Cropper. And plus it's, you know, Booker T and the MGs and that whole little unit. I mean, it's backed so many artists and been on so many hit records. It's crazy.
Well, it's funny you say that, to me at least, because I look at your resume and you participated in some of my favorite records ever recorded.
Yeah, I played on some things, that's for sure.
Your involvement with George Harrison on All Things Must Pass, Rolling Stones' Beggar's Banquet, Jimi Hendrix's Electric Ladyland. You had a hand in the creation of some of the most iconic music of rock and roll history.
Well, I guess so.
Well, and then, of course, not to mention Traffic and your own solo work as well.
But between the two of us, there's a combined 100 years of rock and roll history.
Tell me a bit, if you could, about the band that you're bringing on tour with you.
Well, the band's basically my band, and Steve's just become part of it. So it's my band with Alvino Bennett and drums and Tony Patlick, keyboards and bass, and who also gets to sing Soul Man and Knock on Wood, and John Sambutero plays guitar and does a little keyboard stuff. And he was lead singer with Firefall for 7 years. And he sang on God knows how many albums from Meatloaf to Andy Gibb. And then our latest addition to my band is a really great girl singer named Gretchen Rhodes. And she's singing backup with me, but also singing some of Cropper's stuff, Dock of the Bay, that he co-wrote. Thing is that I didn't realize until I started doing this is how few people know who the hell this guy is, which is, to me, amazing. I mean, you're talking about the guitarist that was with Booker T and the MGs that backed pretty much every record that came out of Stax and all the artists combined. So the list is endless. It's amazing. So the part of it is I'm hoping to, you know, address a situation whereby there's an iconic piece of Americana here that most people are just not even aware of. I mean, other than maybe, you know, that little blip called, you know, in there called the Blues Brothers, which is nothing. It's just a blip in this man's, you know, what he's really done. So, you know, and that's the kind of stuff I was listening to when I was learning, you know, 16, 17, 18 years old. To be able to work with him is just, for me, is a great honor. And I've been doing Dave for over 50 years, and I felt like I wanted to do something a little different and just go out and have fun and put a great show together. And just it's just one song after another. There is no dead weight in the whole show. And so we get combined to do some of my stuff and some of the songs that Steve's written, co-written, and played on. And also we throw in a couple of sort of older rock and roll tunes for fun and just basically try to put a great show together, music, great songs, mostly.
You were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a member of Traffic in 2004. What was that experience like?
That was interesting. You know, it was nice that they inducted us. I mean, I think the great part of it was the whole show. I mean, who performed and who was inducted on that show was amazing. It was Prince, Silver Bullet Band, the Bob Seger, Jackson Browne, ZZ Top, and Traffic. I mean, that was the lineup, which was pretty amazing.
And you have a new album out called Pink Lipstick. Is this with the band that you're touring with currently?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there's a new CD. I mean, I make some new music. I don't really put it out. It's available from my website, and it's available at the shows. But I don't really put anything out anymore because it's a waste of time.
Why do you say that?
Well, there's no promotion. There's no radio anymore. There's no way of getting it played. I mean, it's been a waste of time since they figured out MP3s on the internet. Killed record sales, which most people aren't aware of, but that's just the way it is. And so it becomes a little bit of an exercise in futility. The cost, I mean, it's, you know, the cost of having to make an album is, you know, it's just to do it is expensive. So I just do stuff at home and put some new when I want to do it. But otherwise, it's, you know, putting it out there is just not an option really for especially for a classic artist.
But as a musician, as an artist, do you still feel the need to be creating and producing and putting out work?
Not really. I'm a working musician. I like playing. That's what I like doing. I mean, I have a studio because I like to play around in it and work on things. But whether they ever come out or not, I don't know.
I was wondering if you could take some time to tell me a bit about this organization you work with called Rock Our Vets.
Rock Our Vets, that's a charity, 501c3, all volunteer charity that I do with a friend of mine, Teddy Knapp, based out of New Jersey. And we support all uniformed organizations, firefighters, law enforcement. Mostly we focus on vets, and we look for, you know, donations of not particularly money, but things, clothes, anything, computers, cars, vans, just things that people can use. And we try to do our little bit to help those people get, you know, support themselves and stand on their own 2 feet.
So do you do performances as a fundraiser for this organization?
I do stuff at the East Coast a lot. Ted will come along and we will auction off slang guitars, basically, is what I do.
Dave Mason, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
In a way, haven't seen you in a while. How've you been? Have you changed your style? And do you think that we've grown up differently? Don't seem the same. Seems you've lost your feel for me.
I also got the opportunity to speak with Steve Cropper. Steve Cropper, thanks for taking the time to speak with me today.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Tell me a bit about this tour that you're putting together with Dave Mason, the Rock and Soul Review.
Well, you know, I don't even know when it actually started, but they started talking about, you know, coming up. And Dave and I have been friends for a long, long time. I met him back when I lived in Los Angeles, but we never played together. I mean, we're different schools and different things, and I was always in Europe with the Blues Brothers and have been for 30 years, and they came up with this tour, and I said, yeah, I'll sign on to it. So we're going to do it. We've already done one show, and it turned out pretty good. So my understanding is they taped it. So we actually start the tour. The first show will be July the 5th. And when do we get your way?
July 13th.
July 13th, okay. And we start on the 5th, July 5th, so it won't be too long after that. And my understanding is they taped it, and they're going to probably present that as a CD or DVD, whatever, of the whole show for the audience if they want to purchase one. This tour is pretty good. We've done it, and the members of Dave's band and playing with Dave, and, you know, I have respect for his song, has respect for mine, and sings a few of them, and it all works out pretty good. It's a good show.
Well, I have to ask you about Stax and the formation of Stax Records and your involvement with that.
Well, my involvement, I think, comes simple, but maybe complicated to other people. A friend of mine in school who played saxophone and was taking sax lessons told me in a conversation that his uncle, who was Jim Stewart, had a recording studio in North Memphis, which got my attention. And he didn't really have a studio. He had some recording equipment in a garage. And that got started. And then later, through his mom, Estelle Axton, so Jim Stewart, S-T, and Estelle Axton, her married name, A-X Stewart Ax, S-T-A-X. And that's where it came up with Stax, if you want to know that one. But anyway, they progressed and they found this property out in a place called Brunswick, Tennessee. And she said, well, I understand you're going to do a studio, to her brother, Jim, and I still want to do a record shop. And so they did that. Then Chip Smallman, who was the engineer and a friend of Jim's, said there's this property that became available in South Memphis, and they could get it. Well, Jim didn't really have the money, and he went to his sister, Estelle, and she mortgaged her home so they could get the down payment on that property. And that's where Stax Records was born. And my connection was real simple. I had a band that her son, Estelle's son, had joined. Packy Charles Axton became a great saxophone player. And I had a band in school. It later became the Marquise. And we recorded a hit. Jim Stewart said we'd never make it, but we recorded a hit that Jerry Lee Smoochie Smith wrote called, and we titled it Last Night. And what I didn't know for years, I always wondered, why was that record such a big record? It was pretty good, but I didn't understand why it was so big. It was the first twist instrumental, and I didn't look at it in those days. I just looked at it as instrumental. And I remember my mother twisting to it when I played it for her. She started twisting. And that was just the dance of the day. Well, the twist had already been out. Hank Ballard, the Midnighters, did it. People like Pat Boone caught on to it and did versions of it and all that kind of stuff. So I'm just thinking of the song as being the twist, the song, the twist with lyrics. I wasn't thinking of an instrumental one. It just happened to be the beat of the day, and it happened to work.
Well, that was back in the day when you were making records and physically bringing them to the DJs.
I actually did. That is a true story. And that's how we kind of broke Last Night that way, but we definitely broke Booker T and the MGs' Green Onions that way. And I jumped in a car with a friend of mine who was going over to, well, we went down to Mississippi, went over to Arkansas and whatever. He called on jukebox operators. So we had a trunk of DJ samples on records, and especially the Green Onion song, and he was calling on jukebox operators with all of the stuff that the distributor had. And he would drop me off at a local radio station wherever we were. If we were in Fort Smith or Little Rock, or we went all the way to Texarkana, all the way across the state and back, different places. And I would go in and with a record and say, would you listen to this? Could you spin it? Would you listen to it? And within a week, they played it, and people loved it, and they would call in and say, play that again. So it was kind of an overnight smash in that respect. Took about a week for it to catch on.
Now, I understand from previous interviews that you've given that Green Onions was the B-side.
That is not true.
No?
Green Onions was the A. Well, yes and no. Jim Stewart wanted the ballad on the back, the slow blues, to be the A-side. But I kind of knew better. I was more in the dance genre, and we'd just come off of Last Night, kind of, you know, the year before. So I had a friend of mine, Reuben Washington, on WLOK at drive time. We used to go down there and hang out anyway. And I said, play this and tell me what you think. This is something we cut on Sunday. And I went over on a Monday, had Scotty Moore cut me a dub on it. And then on Tuesday morning, I went down to Reuben's show. And what I didn't know, he backed it up and I went, oh, he doesn't like it. He said, no, I just want to hear that intro again. What he did, he flipped the switch and put it out on the air. And so when I got up at the record shop, Mrs. Axton said, what have you done? The phones are ringing off the wall. People want to know where they can buy this record that nobody knows what it is. And we didn't. We didn't have a title for it or anything. It wasn't Green Onions at the time. I mean, it didn't get that until we had a meeting that afternoon, that Tuesday afternoon, and named the group and named the record. So I guess really the other side was what Jim Stewart had intended to be the B-side. Or the A-side, I'm sorry.
One great thing about Stax Records that I think goes understated is that at Stax was really the first time that black and white musicians played together, and it really wasn't even a big deal at the time.
Not a big deal at all. There was absolutely zero color or discrimination in Stax. There may have been some outside or whatever, because Memphis was a very, very segregated town. I did not really know that. I didn't grow up thinking that. And I didn't think anything wrong with it, neither did they. So, when we went into the Stax studios, we were all there for the same purpose. We didn't look at each other as being different by any means. That was all maybe forced on us later in life, which everybody had to deal with that, and they still do today. It's kind of weird that they have to deal with it. I don't understand it. But I've had many, many people back me up on what I said on that about Stax. There was absolutely no color differentiation or discrimination at Stax at the time. Not from the employees, not from the owners, not from anybody. It just didn't exist.
When I went to visit Stax a few years ago, they made reference to the fact that the end of Stax Records sort of coincides with the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Not that there's a direct correlation, but it seemed to be kind of a catalyst of all things happening at the same time.
A lot of things happened, but I think if you look at the records, that Stax had so many hits after that all went down and was very prominent in the industry. So the industry kind of caused the downfall of Stax. It just wasn't, I think the downfall of some of the radio stations getting rid of a lot of disc jockeys. They quit playing R&B as such that we were making the kind of music we made and went into a different genre of music. And also, Stax grew so big that we couldn't have, like Booker T and the MGs was the house band. You couldn't get everybody all the time. They all had different jobs. And, Al Jackson, our drummer, had artists that he was working with. Booker had artists he was working with, and I had artists I was working with, and so did Donald Duck Dunn. So we couldn't always get everybody in the studio at the same time. You could get some of them, but not all four of us in one session. And that might have been, the change of music, and I think the style. I think music actually changed, and they just weren't buying what we did anymore in the early 70s.
The actual facility, the physical building of Stax Records was torn down, but now there's a reconstruction of it. And next door, you have the Stax Music Academy. Could you tell me about that and if you're involved with
that? Well, even though I may be on the board, I don't know in detail. You'd have to ask somebody else about the details. All I know is it's extremely successful. We've had a lot of students graduate and go to other colleges and do wonderful. And they also have a band that I think they kind of refer to as the new MGs that did a world tour and went over to Europe last year and was, very successful on that. And I hope they continue that. Of course, those boys are getting a lot older now. And they've been around, but so some of them will probably go back to the academy and do some teaching and stuff, and I hope they do that and continue. They're very good. I played with them a few years ago and highly respected, and they're great. So that's a good turnout. It's not just a music academy. It starts out to be that way, but they do pretty much everything. And they're expanding all the time. They're expanding, building new buildings, and I just think it's great, and it's really helped that whole neighborhood, I think. And it was real sad at the time that they had tore down that building. And we went down there when they put up a sign, and it sort of said, Stax Records was born here, used to be here, that kind of a thing. And it was kind of sad to see that. But the floor was still there. And, you can't tear down hallowed ground unless you dig it up, throw it away. So it was kind of good that when they decided to do the museum, that they were able to recreate and have the space to do it, and they didn't have to start from scratch and tear down something. It was already torn down. And they did a good job on it. And then somebody came up with the idea with the academy. I really don't know who came up with the idea. It was a great idea. I think the idea was born out of, let's teach the new generation about what we used to do. And that just turned out to be hands over fist, I guess. It's just wonderful what happened. And I've been in the museum, and other people have too, but I physically have been there. Not in detail, but I've been through it a couple of times. And they really did a great job on it. If you, enjoy seeing things and going to museums, they did a wonderful job on it.
One of the things that struck me about the museum the most, I guess, of all the iconic, guitars and stage costumes and everything, they have Otis Redding's draft card. And that was the one where I just kind of had to pause for a minute and just kind of, it stopped me in my tracks.
Yeah, well, that's pretty good. There's a lot of stuff in there. I mean, most people go over, like to see and stand there and look at Isaac Hayes' gold Cadillac, which is on display. But you're right about that. That's pretty cool. The video that they did on the opening, I think is pretty good. Now, they've been changing it some, but it's a pretty good video to get you started on your excursion through what it was. And so the studio itself, where we recorded, they kept the... Of course, the building was tore down, but they had the old blueprints and all still on file downtown. So they kind of went by that and kept the angle of the floor of the theater, the studio control room up on the stage part where the stage would have been for the movies and all that sort of stuff. And we actually mixed several songs. We kept the old speaker that was in there that was the big sound system and speaker for the movie theater. And we were allowed to keep that. That was still around. And my involvement in the studio itself was that they got Packy, Charles Axton, our sax player, and myself came down there. There were a lot of bolts in the floor where the chairs came up. Well, some of them wouldn't come up. So we had to sit there with a hammer and, you know, back and forth until they would get hot and break off. And we did that so there wouldn't be lumps in the carpet when we put the carpet down. And I think I said I will take credit for something. We had to hang a curtain up to close off what was left on the other side, which later became Studio B. And so I remember Packy's dad saying that, how are we going to hang a curtain? I said, well, let's get a, why don't we use copper tubing as a curtain rod? And because we could form it and curve it and do whatever we wanted to do. And we did. We, you know, got up there with a tall ladder scaffolding and put in hooks and hung up a drape down over the acoustic walls that were built. And they were, the walls, I think, were about eight feet high, something like that. But that was a tall ceiling, too. It went from 13-something up top to about 23 feet, I think, at the bottom, something like that. That's still there. I mean, they built it exactly to the original blueprints.
It is a massive room. And then it, when you walk in, there is Booker's Hammond organ and your Telecaster and Donald Dunn's bass. And they're all behind glass for display. And it's just, it's almost hallowed ground.
Well, thanks for saying so. And it is. There's magic there. And they finally got a friend called me and he said, you wouldn't hear, but I've had a conversation in the studio with Jim Stewart. And it was very difficult to get Jim out to do anything like that to do. And so a friend of mine had him down there. Jim is still around. John Fry is not. He was the head of art. And he said, I talked to Jim. He called me and he said, Jim went into this thing as though nothing had ever happened. It was still their Stack studio. And I thought it was real interesting, and he opened up a lot and said a lot of stuff, so that's pretty cool.
You made reference earlier to the rebuilding of Stax Records. You know, they had the sign in place, but the building wasn't there. And another thing that struck me when I was in Memphis is the similarities between Memphis and Cincinnati. The streetcar, for one, the revitalization of downtown.
Right.
And we have undergoing right now a process to restore King Records. And you, again, you made reference...
That's a great idea.
You made reference earlier to Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, and a lot of their great recordings were done at King Records.
All that stuff. You bet. Well, a lot of people don't know this either. Donald Doug Dunn, the bass player, his brother, a little older, but he had several brothers, but the one closest to him was Bobby, a very good friend of ours. King had a distributorship in Memphis, and Bobby Dunn ran that. And we used to go over there, and we could listen to all those new records that came in. And we just wear them out. Hey, I got this in. And Duck and I would be down there, and we'd listen. And, oh, man, to have free access to something like that. I mean, they had new stuff that wasn't even in the record shop. We could always play records in the record shop if we had them. But King Records had all their new stuff, and we'd go down there and listen to it.
Another thing that struck me was when I was taking the tour of Sun Records when I was there, they have a little sort of a mock-up of what a DJ booth used to look like, and sitting on the turntable was a King Records 45.
Ah, that's great. Yeah. That's great. I don't know where that came out. That booth or whatever they did, mock, may have come out of Muscle Shoals because Sam, you know, had a radio station in Muscle Shoals that had all female DJs, and I didn't even know that for years. But in that, where I signed my first songwriting contract, a writer's contract, and that was a little song recorded by Bill Justice on the flip side of something like Canadian Sunstroke or something like that. And my song was called Flea Circus. It was on the flip side, and that was in the days when records had an A side and a B side. And King used to have to do that too. So what the disc jockeys would do when they would just literally wear out the A side and get tired of playing it, they'd flip over and play the B side, and that would go up the charts. And that happened to us a few times. So I thought that was pretty funny. That it wasn't intended. It was intended to be a B side, not an A side, not a single to be, you know, released and bought by the fans. But a lot of it did, and I know King experienced that as well as Stax did. A lot of record labels did.
Another thing I want to ask you about, because I know you're closely tied to the community in Memphis, and you're also kind of iconically known as playing a Fender Telecaster, but I want to ask you about Gibson guitars. They're filing a bankruptcy. They're closing of the factory in Memphis. What kind of impact do you think that has had on the Memphis city?
I'm not sure, and I was in Memphis playing the Danny Thomas Pro-Am or Celebrity Amateur last Monday. And I asked about it, and I had a very good friend who's connected to Henry and all that. Henry is a friend of mine, too, but I don't talk to him on a regular basis. I just know him from the company. And I'm trying to find out more myself as to what actually has happened. And I was down there and saw the plant across from the FedEx Forum that's closed now. We had many events in there. I've been through that plant. I have several guitars that were made in that plant. And a lot of people don't know that I started with a Gibson guitar. And played one for years. And then when I started doing sessions, I found out that the Telecaster was a little more versatile in terms of playing, you know, broad chords and whatever. Because a Gibson, as good as it is great for single note solos and stuff. But when you go to play chords, it also sounds good if you do it correctly. If you don't, it'll sound a little bit distorted. And that's what we try to stay away from. You know, I got pretty well known for my backbeats and all that, and they used to call them chinks because of the sound that it made, chinks or whatever you call them. And a lot of guitar players think it was an upstroke, but I did it as a downstroke. Mm-hmm. And I muted the strings with my fingers, so I got this nice crack. And I used to play it with a drummer, and I had a trick for doing that as well. But so we came down exactly together, so there wasn't any what we would call technically a flam, where they didn't quite hit exactly the same. And I kind of came up with a little trick to tighten that up, because in those days we didn't cut with headphones and you didn't hear it that way. So there was this what they call the Doppler effect. So the distance between something and when you heard something. And my trick was very simple. I would watch the drummer's left hand and come down with his left hand, and that way we would hit together. And it made it a bigger drum beat. And in the middle of all that stuff, in between that, I say in the middle, but in between those things, I would play fills when it was necessary. And I'd play fills in such a way I completed the melody the singer was singing, and you didn't notice that the backbeats went away. And then I'd go right back to it. I'd play a little short fill and then go right back to playing the backbeats in the time. So that was kind of a session trick. And I just found out that the Fender Telecaster at that time was better for doing that kind of stuff than any other guitar, whether it be a Gretsch or Gibson or whatever. And it did. I still play that style today. I still play a Tele. And I will tell the fans, mine does not necessarily, I do have plenty with the Fender brand on it, but I have the ones I play don't have the Fender brand. Some of the ones I played, the one I play today, I don't play but one at a time. The one I'm playing right now, I've been playing 9.5 years. The other one I retired, I played it about 14 years, long time. And there's no reason. It's just they took some of my favorite Tellers, I think three of them in total, averaged the neck, and that's the neck that was built for the proper classic PV guitar. And the only, I'm not going to say the only reason, but one of the main reasons I went with Hartley PV and the PV guitars was that he said he'd make me a guitar that could be bought for under $1,000. And if anybody's in the guitar business, they know they want to go buy a vintage Fender Telecaster. It's going to cost them upwards of about $5,000 to get one. So my theory was that when a kid says, "Dad, I want a guitar for Christmas," he's going, "Oh, my God, it's like buying a car." So I said, I want them to be able to buy a real playable guitar that will work on stage or in the studio for less than $1,000. And if they buy that, you know, the case and all that other gear to go with it, then probably will be a bigger investment. But the bass on the guitar, the bass price of the guitar would be under $1,000. And I think they had one for 900 and something is the way it turned out.
And it's basically the exact same model that you play on
stage.
Well,
it would be pretty close to the same thing I play all the time, yeah. Very close to it.
You recently played on the Conan O'Brien show, and they talked about this was the 50th anniversary of Sitting on the Dock of the Bay by Otis Redding. What can you say about your time spent with Otis?
It was unbelievable. The thing about Otis, back on when we talked about the non-color, non-discrimination at Stax, I will say and still believe that today, that Otis Redding, as a person, was the most non-prejudiced human being I ever came in contact with on any level. He's just amazing. He was fun, and I only got to be with him and hung out with him a little bit. One time in New York, and the other time is a little more when we recorded in Memphis. But I didn't go down to his ranch. I didn't hang out with him when he was off and not on tour. And he was on tour a lot. He was always gone. So when we used to get Otis, we only got him for a day or two at the most. Until that last group of sessions that we did, and he was off and hadn't gone on tour yet, and he was getting over a throat operation. And he did Monterey, and then he went into this throat operation, and he hadn't gone back on tour yet. And so Ron Capone, the engineer, came to me and he said, "Do you realize how well that Otis is singing?" I said, "Yeah, let's get out some of those old tracks and redo his vocal." And we did on several of them, about four or five songs. But we recorded Dock of the Bay, probably one of the first things that we recorded with not the full band. And that caused me to overdub. And we knew it wasn't finished, but we were going to finish. And Otis and I talked about what we might or might not do with it. And we knew it wasn't complete. And I thought, well, one thing in my work is the guitar licks, which he never heard. He said, popped his head in the studio and said, "I'll see you on Monday." Well, he's going out to go do some gigs. And he never heard that because, the plane went down on a Sunday morning. So I was going to play it to him when he got back on Monday and didn't. And I wound up having to do something else to it and mix it and get it out. And I started it on a Tuesday morning at 7:30. And handed it to a flight attendant who was on a plane going to LaGuardia Airport. And she had the masters and handed them to, or the master and handed them to a representative from Atlantic in New York at LaGuardia. And he immediately put them in the vat, what we call the vat, to make parts for the record release. And that was a toughie. And that's where the idea, I knew it wasn't finished and it needed something. What are you going to do? It's too late to book a session for strings, too late to book backgrounds. And so I came up with the idea of the ocean waves and the seagulls, kind of fill it out a little bit, and it seemed to work, I guess. So when you asked me about it being 50 years old and doing Conan, my relationship with Otis was priceless. But the fact that it sort of ages me and dates me and says, "This song is 50 years old, good Lord," man, I don't feel that. I mean, I know I'm a lot older than that. Otis and I were the same age. So he would have been my age. And he was born in September and I was born in October. So there's less than 30-something days between our birthdays. He was, the 11th of September and I was the 21st of October the following month. So a little more than 30 days when I do the math. The difference between, I guess it's 10 days, right?
Yeah.
11 and 21 be 10. So however many days that is from the September 11th to October 21st, I don't know. And I had no idea. I really did not know how old Otis was. Never asked him, never thought about it. I looked up at him as an older brother that I never had. And we always had a good time together. So that's my relationship with Otis Redding. The other thing about Otis as a singer, I only know one other person that did this, and I will give credit to him. When they sang, whether it was a demo or whether they knew that the lyrics would change, they sang it like it was the last song they were ever going to sing. And Rod Stewart did the same thing when Tom Dowd was producing Rod Stewart. I said, "Man, he treats it like Otis did. He sings every song knowing that he's going to rewrite it like it's the last song he's ever going to do." And it's hard to get artists to sing like that in front of a microphone in a studio. I mean, there's tons of great singers, and always will be tons of great singers. So a lot of these young kids, just astounding what they know, especially guitar players and other musicians as well. What they're actually capable of at the young age they are is mind-boggling. It's way above my talent. I'm still trying to learn.
Well, I can't even put into words how grateful I am to be able to spend so much time speaking with you today. This has been just marvelous. Thank you so much, and I hope you have a wonderful day and a great tour.
All right, you bet.
I've been speaking with guitar greats Dave Mason and Steve Cropper about their upcoming Rock and Soul Review tour. The Rock and Soul Review comes to Bechtold Park in Sycamore Township on Friday, July 13th. For links to tickets and more information, please visit wvxu.org/aroundcincinnati. I'm Jim Nolan.
I'm just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm sitting on the dock of